Every single second, roughly 100 trillion invisible entities are passing completely through your body.
It is a staggering number to even try to conceptualize.
Right. I mean, they are streaming through the ceiling, slicing through your cells, traveling right through the floor, and then they just continue, completely unbothered, through the solid molten core of the Earth.
Yeah, orthodox physics calls them ghost particles. Or, you know, neutrinos.
Exactly. And for nearly a century now, we've been told a very specific story about what these ghosts actually are. We've been taught that they, along with pretty much every other fundamental building block in the universe, are what we call point particles.
Dimensionless dots.
Yeah, dimensionless dots. Like infinitely small specks with absolutely zero volume zooming around in this empty void.
Which is, it's the bedrock assumption of modern quantum mechanics.
Right. But what if that foundational assumption isn't just, you know, slightly off? What if assuming the universe is made of infinitely small dots is actually the biggest mistake in the history of science?
That is a massive question.
It really is. What if those 100 trillion ghosts passing through you right now aren't dots at all? What if they're actually microscopic, mathematically perfect, three-dimensional knots? Like hydroplaning across a dense, icy, pentagonal floor of reality.
I mean, it sounds like complete science fiction when you first say it out loud.
It really does.
But the stack of theoretical physics papers we are examining today suggests exactly that.
And that is why we are so thrilled to be taking this deep dive with you today. You, the inherently curious learner. You know, the person who doesn't just want to accept the world as a given, but really wants to know how the gears actually turn.
And today, the mission is massive.
Yeah, we are unpacking a radical, incredibly dense, and potentially paradigm-shattering theoretical framework. It's called the Noellian Universe Theory, or KUT for short.
Specifically, we're looking at a set of papers detailing what they called the Dirac-Lynch synthesis.
It is such a remarkable collection of sources. We are talking about a complete rethinking of the structural foundations of reality.
We really are. And what's fascinating here is the philosophical pivot required just to even approach this material. To understand these sources, you have to transition your mind from what the authors call noun grammar to verb grammar.
Okay, let's unpack this. What exactly do you mean by noun grammar versus verb grammar?
Well, standard physics operates on noun grammar. It treats particles as static things, like an electron is an object. A quark is an object.
Right, like a tiny billiard ball.
Exactly. And these objects possess properties like mass or charge or spin. Mm-hmm. And those properties are sort of stored inside them, almost like luggage packed into the trunk of a car.
Okay, so that's the noun part.
Right. But the Dirac-Lynch synthesis demands verb grammar. Mm. It argues that particles are not static things at all. They are ongoing geometric performances.
Wait, performances?
Yeah, a particle is an action. It is a continuous knotting process, rendering itself into reality moment by moment.
So an electron isn't a noun. It isn't a thing. It's more like a tiny tornado. I mean, the tornado isn't an object, right? It's an event. It's the performance of wind doing a specific geometric dance.
That is a perfect analogy. If the wind stops performing that dance, the tornado doesn't just go somewhere else. It ceases to exist.
It just stops.
Exactly. The Noellian Universe Theory proposes that all matter works this way. And the backdrop you see behind me, this mesmerizing, glowing, pentagonal grid, that's a visual representation of what they call the Chiroq lattice.
Which is like the stage.
Yes, it's the stage upon which that geometric performance actually takes place.
But wait, let me stop you there. Because if we are going to claim that the entire foundation of modern particle physics has a huge crack in it, and we need to replace it with this verb grammar and pentagonal lattices, we really need to understand exactly why the old model is broken.
We do. We have to look at the failures.
Right. Like, why do these sources argue that modeling an electron or a neutrino as a zero-volume point particle is a catastrophic error? Let's talk about the problem with points.
To understand the failure, we first have to understand why physicists adopted the point particle model in the first place. I mean, it wasn't arbitrary.
No, standard quantum electrodynamics, or QED, is arguably the most successful scientific theory in human history.
It really is. By treating the electron as a dimensionless point, physicists have been able to calculate the electromagnetic interactions of particles to an astonishing degree of accuracy.
We are talking about predictions matching experimental data out to 12 decimal places.
12 decimal places.
That is like predicting the distance from New York to Los Angeles down to the exact width of a human hair.
Precisely. So orthodox physicists use point particles because, well, the math works spectacularly well.
But if the math works so beautifully, why are the authors of these KUT papers saying it broke physics? I mean, why fix what isn't broken?
Because while the predictive output works, the underlying structural math, you know, the ontology of what is actually happening, it literally breaks down into impossibilities.
Impossibilities like what?
It all comes down to the math of infinities. If you treat an electron as a true geometric point with exactly zero spatial extent, and you embed that point in a flat, continuous background void, you run into an immediate, devastating problem.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Think about the electromagnetic field energy surrounding a charged particle. As you get closer and closer to the charge, the energy gets higher and higher.
That makes intuitive sense. I mean, the closer you are to the fire, the hotter it is.
Right. But if the electron is a true point, its radius is exactly zero. So as the distance from the center goes all the way to absolute zero, the energy density shoots up to infinity.
Oh, because you are trying to pack a finite amount of charge into an infinitely small space.
Yes. In physics, this creates an impossible mathematical result called an ultraviolet divergence.
Oh, I see. Because the space is zero, you're essentially dividing the charge by zero in the equation. And anytime you divide by zero in math, the whole thing just explodes into infinity.
Exactly. The math literally breaks. You cannot have infinite energy density sitting inside a single atom.
So how do they fix it?
To deal with this glaring impossibility, mid-20th century physicists developed a mathematical workaround called renormalization.
Renormalization. Mm. I've heard that term thrown around a lot in physics documentaries, usually right before things get incredibly confusing for the audience. What is it in plain English?
In the simplest terms, renormalization is a highly sophisticated technique of systematically subtracting mathematically generated infinities from other mathematically generated infinities.
Wait, what?
Yeah. They subtract infinities from infinities, hoping that what you are left with is a finite, measurable number that matches what you see in the lab.
Wait a second. You're subtracting infinity from infinity? That sounds like something a middle school math teacher would absolutely fail you for doing on a test.
It is deeply controversial structurally. Richard Feynman, who is actually one of the founding architects of quantum electrodynamics, famously despised this mathematical trick, even though he helped pioneer it.
Really? What did he say about it?
He called it hocus pocus and a dippy process. He recognized that while it works remarkably well for making laboratory predictions, ontologically speaking, it is an admission of failure.
So the sources we are examining today argue that these infinities were never actual properties of nature at all.
Exactly. They are just the catastrophic symptoms of using the wrong geometric model.
So basically, because they refused to give the electron any physical volume, they created a math problem they couldn't solve, and then they invented a magic eraser to just scrub the infinities out of the margins.
That is the core assertion of the Dirac-Lynch synthesis. The point particle was the original sin, and renormalization was the cover-up.
Okay, so that is the electron. But when we look at the neutrino, this problem of wrong models and mathematical fudge factors gets even more blatant.
It really does.
Let's trace this back, because the very invention of the neutrino is one of the wildest stories in physics. It starts with Wolfgang Pauli in 1930, the whole origin of the ghost particle.
Yes, to understand the neutrino, you really have to understand the crisis of beta decay. In the 1920s and 30s, physicists were intensely studying a type of radioactive decay where an atomic nucleus emits an electron. This is called beta decay.
Okay.
Now, the law of conservation of energy, which is the absolute golden rule of physics, states that energy cannot be created or destroyed, only transferred. Mm. This demanded that the energy of the particles before the decay must perfectly match the energy of the particles after the decay.
It's basic accounting. Like, if I have $10 in my wallet and I buy a coffee for $3, I better have $7 left. If I only have $5 left, something is deeply wrong.
Exactly. But when physicists looked at beta decay, the accounting didn't match.
The money was missing.
Yes. A neutron would decay into a proton and an electron. They would add up the energy of the proton and the emitted electron, and it was consistently less than the energy of the original neutron. Energy seemed to be magically disappearing from the universe.
I can imagine physicists in the 1930s were absolutely losing their minds over this.
Oh, they were. Niels Bohr, one of the founding fathers of quantum theory, was so frustrated he was actually ready to completely abandon the law of conservation of energy at the subatomic level.
Wow. He was just going to throw the golden rule out the window.
He was. But Wolfgang Pauli refused to let go of conservation. So in 1930, he wrote a famous letter to a physics conference, starting with, "Dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen."
Classic.
Yeah. And in it, he proposed a desperate remedy. He hypothesized the existence of a new, invisible, electrically neutral particle that was sneaking out of the nucleus and carrying away the missing energy.
So he literally just invented a ghost particle on paper just to balance his checkbook. Like, I'm missing $2, so there must be an invisible thief who stole exactly $2.
That's precisely what he did. And he felt terribly guilty about it. He famously lamented, "I have done a terrible thing. I have postulated a particle that cannot be detected."
Because he assumed it would never be proven, right?
Sure.
Because it had no charge and practically no mass. It was purely a mathematical accounting trick.
But the crazy thing is, the trick turned out to be real. Decades later, we actually found them.
We did. In 1956, using massive vats of water and nuclear reactors, physicists finally detected the elusive neutrino.
It wasn't just a math trick anymore. It was a physical reality. But because it started as a ghost, you know, an anomaly forced into the equations out of sheer desperation to save energy conservation, it has always been treated as an outsider in the standard model of particle physics.
And the plot thickens even more in the 1990s, right? Because for a long time, the standard model assumed Pauli's ghost had absolutely zero mass. It was just a tiny, weightless packet of energy moving at the speed of light.
Correct. The original standard model predicted perfectly massless neutrinos. But then, in 1998, the Super Kamiokande Observatory in Japan made a massive discovery.
Super Kamiokande is wild. For you listening, it's this mind-blowing underground tank filled with 50,000 tons of ultra-pure water lined with light detectors.
Yes, and that observatory made a discovery that shocked the physics world. They confirmed that neutrinos actually oscillate.
Oscillate meaning what exactly?
Right.
Meaning they change their identity. Neutrinos come in three distinct flavors in orthodox physics. The electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino.
Okay, three flavors.
Super Kamiokande proved that as a neutrino travels through space, say from the atmosphere down into the underground detector, it spontaneously morphs from one flavor to another.
Literally, a shape-shifting ghost.
Yes. And this is where the crisis of mass originates. Because according to the strict laws of relativity and quantum mechanics, for a particle to change its state, for it to experience time and undergo a transformation, it cannot be traveling at the absolute speed of light.
Because if you travel at the speed of light, time stops for you. You don't experience change.
Right. Therefore, if the neutrino is changing flavors, it must be experiencing time.
And if it's experiencing time, it must be traveling slightly slower than the speed of light. And if it's traveling slower than light, it must have mass.
Exactly. The Super Kamiokande discovery proved unequivocally that neutrinos have mass. This completely broke the original standard model.
So what do they do?
To fix it, orthodox physics had to retroactively shoehorn neutrino mass into the equations. And this is where we return to the problem of mathematical fudge factors. To describe how these three flavors mix and oscillate, the standard model uses something called the PMNS matrix.
PMNS. What does that stand for?
The Pontecorvo-Maki-Nakagawa-Sakata matrix, named after the physicists who developed it.
Okay, so they built this matrix to explain the shape-shifting. How many manual dials of parameters does this matrix need to make the math actually work with the lab observations?
This is the crux of the issue. To describe the masses and the complex mixing behaviors between the three flavors of neutrinos, the PMNS matrix requires the manual insertion of at least 7 free parameters.
7 free parameters. Let me make sure I understand this and that you listening grasp this too. What exactly is a free parameter in this context?
A free parameter is a number that is not derived or predicted by the theory itself. The theory doesn't know why the number is what it is.
So they're just plugging in numbers.
Yeah, the scientists literally have to run an experiment, measure the result, and then physically write that measured number into their equations by hand to make the model match reality.
Wow.
In the PMNS matrix, these 7 parameters include mixing angles, mass squared differences, and what they call CP violating phases.
Okay, you just dropped a heavy term there. CP violating phases. What does that mean?
In simple terms, CP stands for charge parity. It's a principle that suggests the laws of physics should remain the same if you swap a particle with its antimatter counterpart and mirror its spatial coordinates.
Like a perfect mirror image.
Right. A CP violating phase is essentially a mathematical parameter inserted to account for the fact that neutrinos might behave slightly differently than their antimatter versions, antineutrinos.
So it's another dial.
It's exactly another dial physicists have to turn to explain why the universe has more matter than antimatter.
So we have mixing angles, mass differences, and these antimatter asymmetry dials, seven of them in total. I really want to offer an analogy here because this is starting to remind me of ancient astronomy. Before we realized the Earth revolved around the Sun, we had the Ptolemaic model, where the Earth was at the center of the universe.
Ah, the geocentric model, yes.
Right. And as astronomers looked at the sky, they noticed the planets weren't moving in perfect circles around the Earth. Sometimes Mars would appear to stop and move backwards in the sky.
Retrograde motion.
Exactly. To explain this without giving up the idea that Earth was the center, Ptolemy invented epicycles. He said the planets are moving in little circles while they move in a big circle around the Earth.
Right, circles upon circles.
And as our measurements got better, the astronomers couldn't explain the new data, so they just kept adding more and more little circles, circles on top of circles, just to make the math match the sky.
That is a phenomenal analogy. The epicycles were mathematical fudge factors designed to save a broken foundational model.
Exactly. So orthodox physics using a dimensionless point particle is like putting the Earth at the center of the solar system.
Yeah.
And this seven-parameter PM&S matrix is just a modern version of epicycles. We don't know why the neutrino oscillates, so we just add seven invisible mathematical circles to the equation to make the output match the Super Kamiokande tank.
That is precisely what the sources are arguing.
But the KUT sources are saying, what if we just move the Sun to the center? What if we fix a foundational geometry and suddenly we don't need any of the seven epicycles at all?
That is the central thesis of the Dirac-Lynch synthesis. KUT argues that the neutrino isn't a ghost and the PM&S matrix is a patch for a broken geometry.
So we need a new geometry.
We do. To understand why the neutrino acts the way it does, why it slips through matter and requires these complex matrices in standard physics, we have to leave the world of imaginary points and finally look at the knot.
We need to understand what gives a normal particle its solid substance. Okay, let's dive into the core of this radical new framework, the geometric solution. We are officially ditching the infinitely small dot. If a particle isn't a point, what is it?
The sources introduce the concept of Noellian solitons, or nodes. The claim is that an electron, a proton, a quark, all fermions, are volumetrically bounded entities.
They take up actual space.
Yes. And their specific fundamental geometric shape is the 3-2 torus knot.
A 3-2 torus knot. Okay, for you listening, I want you to picture a donut, a perfectly smooth, hollow torus. Now imagine taking a marker and drawing a continuous line on the surface of that donut. You draw the line so that it loops around the long way, the longitudinal direction, three times.
Three times around the outside?
Right. But simultaneously, as it travels the long way, it loops through the center hole, the radial direction, two times. When the line finally connects back to where it started, you have a 3-2 torus knot. If you've ever seen a Celtic trefoil knot, it's essentially that shape.
That's a great visualization. It's the simplest possible knot you can tie in a closed loop. And the crucial paradigm-shifting detail here is that this knot occupies physical volume.
It's not infinitely small.
Well, no, it is not infinitely small. It has a minimum spatial extent, strictly bounded by what physics calls the Planck volume, the smallest possible meaningful space.
And because it occupies actual volume, the math doesn't break.
Precisely. Because the radius never goes to absolute zero, the electromagnetic energy density never shoots up to infinity.
Oh, wow.
The dreaded ultraviolet divergence is cured instantly by the geometry itself. No mathematical hocus pocus, no renormalization, no subtracting infinity from infinity. The physical shape of the particle prevents the infinity from ever existing in the first place.
But wait, let me push back here, because my brain is still kind of stuck in noun grammar. If a particle's a knot, what is the string? I mean, if you tie a knot in a shoelace, the shoelace is made of cotton, the cotton is made of molecules, the molecules are made of atoms. In KUT, if an electron is a knot, what is the physical material looping around three times and twice?
It's an excellent question, and honestly, it's the hardest thing for our macroscopic brains to grasp. There is no string. There is no physical material.
Then what is knotting?
Space itself. Or, more accurately, the fundamental informational lattice of the universe. The knot is a stable, localized, topological disturbance in the background field.
Like a wave in the ocean.
Think of a whirlpool in a river. What is the whirlpool made of? It's made of the water. But it isn't a separate thing from the water. It is a stable, geometric pattern of movement within the water.
Okay, I see.
The node is a stable pattern of movement, a geometric lock within the rendering space of reality.
A verb, not a noun.
A performance.
Exactly. But a whirlpool cannot exist in a vacuum. It needs water. And a 3-2 torus knot cannot exist in an empty, continuous void. It has to be tied in something.
And this brings us to the stage where the performance takes place.
Yes. The Newellian vacuum is not empty space. It is a structured, discrete rendering manifold called the Cairo Q lattice.
The glowing floor behind you. Yes. Imagine a floor paved entirely with identical five-sided tiles. It's a pentagonal tiling. And the fundamental geometry of this pentagonal floor, the lengths of the sides, the angles, is strictly governed by the golden ratio.
The golden ratio.
Yeah.
Roughly 1.618. We see it everywhere in nature, right? From the spirals of galaxies to the arrangement of leaves on a stem to the shape of a nautilus shell.
Yes, the universe loves the golden ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And the critical mathematical property of the golden ratio is that it is an irrational number. Its decimal expansion goes on forever without repeating.
Okay, so let me summarize this setup here for a second. We have a particle, which is a knot defined by perfect rational whole numbers. Three loops this way, two loops that way, three and two. Very clean.
Very clean.
And we have a fundamental floor of space, a lattice, which is defined by a five-sided geometry governed by an infinitely messy irrational number, the golden ratio.
You have pinpointed the precise dynamic that creates our universe. The incommensurability, the fundamental geometric mismatch between the rational knot and the irrational lattice is everything.
Everything.
Yes, because this conflict leads us to the most mind-bending part of this entire theory, redefining what mass actually is.
Let's do it. Redefining mass.
Yeah.
Because this completely changes how I view my own body.
In orthodox physics, mass is a brute fact. It's just a property stored inside a particle. The electron just has mass the way a red ball has redness. You measure it, write it down, and move on.
Right.
But in the verb grammar of KUT, mass is not a thing. Mass is geometric resistance.
Geometric resistance.
It is the friction, the grinding tax, that is paid when the rational 3x2 knot tries to lock its geometry into the irrational pentagonal Cairo Q lattice.
Okay, I really want to make sure you, the listener, feel this concept. Imagine holding a perfectly square wooden peg, and in front of you is a heavy iron plate with a pentagonal hole. Five sides. Now imagine trying to force that square peg into that pentagonal hole over and over, billions of times a second. It doesn't fit perfectly. There is a geometric mismatch. The heat, the friction, the immense energy it takes to physically force that peg into that hole to deform the space just enough to make it lock in. That grinding is what we perceive as mass.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. The universe charges a topological toll to make potentiality solid. The heavier the particle, the harder it is grinding into the floor of reality to sustain its existence.
So a heavier particle is just a more complicated knot.
Exactly. Take a proton. A proton is about 1,836 times heavier than an electron. Standard physics just says it has more mass. KUT says the proton's complex composite knot structure requires 1,836 times more geometric friction to successfully lock into the pentagonal lattice than the simpler electron knot.
Wow. The mass isn't arbitrary. It's the literal, calculable cost of doing business in this universe.
Yeah.
If you want to be solid, you had to grind against the floor.
The authors call this requirement the Higgs torsion threshold. If a knot pays this grinding tax, it successfully anchors its meridional loops into the pentagonal tiles.
And then it becomes solid.
Yes, it becomes matter. It stops moving at the speed of light and enters the realm of time and gravity.
Okay, but this raises a massive question, a structural what if. What happens if a particle is struck into motion, maybe in the core of a star or in a nuclear reactor, but it simply doesn't have quite enough energy to force that peg into the hole?
It falls short.
Right. What if the event that created it didn't swing the hammer hard enough to pay the Higgs torsion threshold?
That question brings us directly to the star of our show today, the neutrino.
Yes. Let's demystify Pelli's ghost. What happens to the knot that can't pay the toll?
In the Newellian framework, we refer to the creation of a neutrino as a partial rendering event.
A partial rendering? Like a video game graphic that didn't fully load?
Exactly. The universe is incredibly dynamic. High energy events are happening constantly. Nuclear fusion in the sun, beta decay in our laboratories, the catastrophic core collapse of a supernova. In these massive energy transfers, the deep mechanics of the universe strike a node into motion, initiating the knot tying performance.
The engine turns on, the tornado starts spinning.
Yes. But in some of these reactions, the energy transferred to the knot falls just below the Higgs torsion threshold.
So it's spinning, but it can't dock.
The knot begins to form, the longitudinal and meridional loops begin to rotate, but it lacks the necessary activation energy to force its rational geometry into the irrational pentagonal seat.
So it can't anchor.
It cannot anchor. It is denied a permanent parking spot on the Cairo Q lattice because it cannot lock into the solid structural geometry, which KUT refers to as the ash of reality. It exists in a different state of propagation.
And what do they call that state?
The papers call this the liquid instant field.
Liquid instant field, meaning it just slips right over the tiles.
It slips. It propagates through the lattice at the raw, unhindered rendering speed of the universe's background field, which we perceive macroscopically as the speed of light.
It's just flying over the floor.
And because it is slipping rather than grinding, it pays no primary grinding cost.
Okay, let's use another analogy to lock this in. If an anchored particle, like a proton, is a massive, heavy, deeply treaded off-road tire, aggressively gripping a paved road, it generates a ton of heat, traction, and friction. And that friction is mass.
Right.
But the neutrino is like a car driving down that exact same road that suddenly hits a patch of sheer black ice.
That is the exact structural difference.
It's the exact same car. It's the exact same 3.2 torus knot engine. But it's just hydroplaning across the surface without catching traction.
Hydroplaning across the surface. That perfectly captures the mechanics of the partial rendering event. It is not a different species of particle from the electron. It is not an exotic ghost from another dimension.
It's just the same trefoil knot.
Exactly. Just denied the ability to lock. And this hydroplaning perfectly explains the neutrino's notoriously elusive properties.
Right. Because why did Pauli call it a ghost in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Because it has no electrical charge, and it passes through solid matter like it isn't even there.
Yes, and KUT explains why it has no charge. In this geometric theory, electromagnetic charge arises when a knot's loops lock into a stable, polarized orientation on the lattice. You can think of it like a magnet snapping into place.
But the neutrino never snaps into place.
Because the hydroplaning neutrino never locks, it never achieves a stable charge polarity. It spins in neutral. Therefore, it has zero electromagnetic charge, allowing it to slip straight through the electromagnetic fields of solid atoms unbothered.
It's brilliant. Pauli's ghost isn't spooky magic. It's just a knot that hit black ice. But here is the kicker, and this is where we return to the Super Kamiokande Observatory and the problem of the shape-shifting flavors.
The oscillation problem.
Right. Since the car is hydroplaning on black ice and it can't find traction, well, it can't stay still. It's sliding. And as it slides, the car starts to spin out of control. And that spin solves the mystery of the 7-parameter epicycle matrix.
This is the phenomenon the KUT authors call topological phase ringing, and it provides the geometric cure for the illusion of flavor.
Let's set up the flavor mystery again quickly. Orthodox physics observes neutrinos arriving from the sun. As they travel through space, they oscillate, spontaneously transforming between three identities, electron, muon, and tau flavors.
The standard model treats these as three separate distinct particles that are quantum mechanically mixing together in a probability soup.
Right. It's a superposition of mass eigenstates.
But KUT offers a purely geometric, deterministic explanation. We have to look closely at the anatomy of the 3-2 torus knot. Remember the math. It has a meridional winding number of 2, but it requires 3 full longitudinal loops around the donut to fully close the knot.
Okay, a 3-2 ratio.
Because of this ratio, structurally, the knot presents exactly 3 distinct meridional winding faces to the lattice.
3 faces, like a 3-sided shape.
Yes. Now, because this knot is unanchored, because it lacks the energy to lock into the 5-fold pentagonal floor, it cannot hold a single stable presentation.
It's tumbling.
If you have a rational shape trying to rest on an unmatched, irrational floor, and it's hydroplaning forward at light speed, it will continuously slip. And as it slips, it tumbles end over end. It rotates continuously through its 3 distinct winding faces.
Oh, wow. Okay, so what does this mean for this Super Kamiokande tank? It means the electron, muon, and tau neutrinos aren't 3 different particles magically shape-shifting.
No, they aren't.
It's a single 3-sided tumbling die hydroplaning across the ice. The die is constantly rolling. And depending on the exact microsecond you snap the photograph, meaning depending on which of the 3 faces happens to be pointing down at the ice when it smashes into a water molecule in your detector, you label it an electron, a muon, or a tau neutrino.
Flavor is just orientation. That is the revelation of phase ringing. It is a single trefoil node ringing harmonically through the only three distinct orientations its own topology permits.
So it's just the same particle phasing a different way.
Exactly. If the face aligned with the originating event hits your detector, you call it an electron neutrino. If it has tumbled one winding phase further, you call it a muon neutrino. If it has tumbled two winding phases, it's a tau neutrino.
Flager is just orientation that completely eliminates the need for three separate particles. But what about that massive PMNS matrix, the one with the seven free parameters, the mixing angles, and the CP violating phases? How does KUT explain all the math the orthodox physicists are doing?
Beautifully. The PMNS matrix in the KUT framework is simply the flat space shadow of this three-dimensional tumbling knot.
A shadow?
Yes. Imagine taking a 3D knot, tumbling it across a 5D mathematical lattice, and then trying to project that complex movement onto a flat 2D wall.
You lose so much information.
Exactly. Standard model mathematics is built for 1D point particles in a flat void space. When they measure the complex tumbling of the neutrino using tools built for point particles, they don't see a tumbling 3D knot. They see a confusing, overlapping probability matrix of mixing angles and phase shifts.
So the angles are real.
The mixing angles aren't arbitrary dials. They are literal geometric projections of the knot's rotational angle at the exact moment of impact.
So the orthodox physicists aren't crazy. They're accurately measuring the shadow on the wall. They just don't realize the shadow is being cast by a tumbling knot.
Exactly. KUT explains why there are three flavors, because the 3-2 knot has exactly three meridional faces. The standard model cannot explain why there are three generations of particles. It cannot explain why the mixing angles are the specific numbers they are.
It just accepts them as brute facts.
Right. It accepts them, measures the shadow, and adds an epicycle.
Okay, this is an incredibly elegant metaphor. The tumbling die on the ice. But as any physicist listening right now is screaming at their speakers, metaphors do not win Nobel Prizes. They certainly do not. Physics requires rigorous math. If you're going to claim you can replace the PMNS matrix, you better have the equations to back it up. And the KUT sources don't just stop at metaphors. They provide a mathematical proof that this tumbling act generates the exact microscopic mass of the neutrino.
Yes. This is where the Dirac-Lynch synthesis transitions from a fascinating philosophical interpretation into a hard, predictive scientific theory. This is the 10th derivation.
Walk us through the heavy lifting. How do you mathematically calculate the mass of hydroplaning knot? And keep in mind, they do this with zero free parameters. They aren't feeding any lab data into the equation.
Right. Zero parameters. We are deriving the mass scale using only the fundamental topological constants of the knot and the lattice. The authors call this derivation the harmonic suppression steps. We can build the equation right now, step by step.
I'm ready. Let's do the math.
Step one, establishing the reference scale. In the Noellian universe, you don't just invent numbers out of nowhere. All mass scales must be anchored to the primary mechanism of mass generation, which is the proton.
Because it's fully anchored.
Yes. The proton is the ultimate anchored node. It represents the primary first-order grinding cost against the pentagonal lattice. Its mass is approximately 938 million electron volts, or 938 MeV.
Okay, baseline established. 938 million EV. That is our starting block.
Step two, the suppression hierarchy. We know the neutrino is not fully anchored. It slips rather than grinds. Therefore, its mass, its friction, is not a direct first-order cost like the proton. It is a faint harmonic echo.
Because it's tumbling.
Exactly. Because the unanchored knot is tumbling and phase-ringing through its three distinct faces, it only makes fractional, fleeting, imperfect contact with the lattice.
So we need to calculate the geometric mismatch, the gap.
Yes. This is calculated using the Noellian offset, denoted mathematically as epsilon KW. Epsilon is simply the exact mathematical difference between the irrational geometry of the pentagonal floor and the rational geometry of the knot.
So we take the numbers.
You take the golden ratio, approximately 1.618, and you subtract the knot's rational winding ratio, which is three loops divided by two loops, or 1.5.
1.618 minus 1.500. So the Noellian offset is roughly 0.118. That is the physical size of the gap causing the slippage.
Correct. But remember, the knot is tumbling through exactly three faces. So the friction isn't just suppressed once. It is suppressed across all three phases of its rotation.
Meaning we have to multiply it by itself.
Mathematically, we must cube the offset. We take 0.118 and raise it to the third power.
So 0.118 times 0.118 times 0.118, that gives us a very small fraction, roughly 0.0016.
Exactly. We call that the third order harmonic echo, but there is one final suppression step, step three, the lattice closure penalty.
Why is there a penalty?
Because the neutrino is tumbling because it hit a barrier. It couldn't overcome the energy requirement to lock into the five-fold lattice. The lattice acts as a repellent mathematical wall.
So it pushes back?
Yes. The fractional echo we just calculated is further suppressed by dividing it by the square of this lattice closure barrier.
And how do we calculate the barrier?
It is defined by the Knott's winding sum. 3 longitudinal loops plus 2 meridional loops equals 5. 5 is the fundamental barrier number of the pentagonal lattice.
So the square of the 5.
To calculate the final suppression area, we square that number. 5 squared is 25.
Okay, I have all the pieces. Let me put the equation together for the listener. We start with the proton mass baseline, 938 million electron volts. We multiply that by the cubed Noëlian offset, which is roughly 0.00016, representing the three tumbling faces slipping across the gap.
Correct.
And then we divide that entire number by 25, which is the lattice closure penalty. That's the whole equation.
That is the complete zero parameter 10th derivation for the characteristic neutrino mass scale.
I need to pause here because I have run these numbers and I know what the output is, but the sheer audacity of this calculation really needs to be acknowledged. When you actually plug those purely geometric constants into a calculator. Wait, the equation spits out a characteristic neutrino mass scale of approximately 0.06 electron volts, 0.06 EV.
That is the derived result, yes.
I want you listening to really grasp the magnitude of what was just outlined here. The KUT physicists did not run a multi-billion dollar particle collider. They didn't gather a petabyte of empirical collision data, find a tiny anomaly, and say, ah, the mass is 0.06 EV.
No, they didn't.
No. They looked at the theoretical geometry of a knot. They looked at the geometry of a pentagon. They calculated the abstract theoretical friction of that knot tumbling across that pentagon based purely on topological mathematics. And they predicted that the mass of a neutrino must be exactly 0.06 EV.
It is the profound difference between descriptive physics and generative physics.
Generative physics, that's a great term.
Standard descriptive physics measures the world with a ruler, writes down a number, and then builds a matrix to accommodate it. Generative physics starts with foundational mathematical truth and derives a proof showing that the universe must be the way it is. It removes the arbitrary nature of the cosmos.
But, and this is a massive but, a mathematical flex is only a flex if it matches reality. I mean, I can invent a beautiful equation that proves the sky should be green, but if I look outside and the sky is blue, my beautiful equation is worthless fairy tale math.
Right. It has to fit the data.
Exactly. If KUT's 10th derivation dictates the neutrino mass is 0.06 EV, how does that hold up against actual real-world observational data?
This is where KUT bridges the gap from theoretical beauty to empirical reality. And interestingly, the most robust constraints on the mass of the neutrino don't currently come from particle accelerators on Earth.
Really? Where do they come from?
They come from the sky. They come from cosmology.
Oh, you're talking about the Planck satellite.
Yes. In 2018, the European Space Agency released the definitive data from the Planck mission. Planck is a space observatory designed to map the cosmic microwave background. That's the faint, lingering thermal afterglow of the Big Bang itself.
So they're looking at ancient light.
By analyzing microscopic temperature fluctuations in this ancient light and combining it with data on how galaxies cluster together over billions of years, cosmologists were able to calculate how much invisible mass must be dragging the universe down.
Because neutrinos are everywhere, right?
Yeah.
If you have 100 trillion passing through one human body, there are countless septillions of them in the universe.
Exactly. And if they were heavy, their combined gravity would clump galaxies together much tighter than what we actually see.
So their weight affects the shape of the universe.
Yes. The way the universe expands and clumps places a strict, non-negotiable upper limit on how heavy these ghosts can be. The 2018 Planck data established an absolute cosmological ceiling. The sum of the masses of all three neutrino flavors must be less than 0.12 electron volts.
Less than 0.12 EV. And the Noëlian geometric derivation, derived entirely from knots and pentagons, states the characteristic scale is 0.06 EV.
It lands absolutely flawlessly within the cosmological window. It is fully consistent with the multi-billion dollar satellite data. The derived scale of roughly 0.06 EV perfectly accommodates the mass squared differences observed in Earth-based oscillation experiments like Super Kamiokande, while strictly obeying the cosmological ceiling set by Planck.
And what blows my mind is contrasting this theoretical prediction with what orthodox physicists are currently doing on Earth right this very second. There are massive, incredibly expensive terrestrial experiments going on, projects like Catron in Germany.
Yes, the Karlsruhe tritium neutrino experiment.
Right. For the listener who hasn't been following German particle physics, what exactly is Catron trying to do, and how does KT view their efforts?
Catron is essentially a gigantic, highly sensitive scale trying to weigh the ghost particle empirically. They do this by observing something called tritium beta decay. Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen. When it decays, it spits out an electron and a neutrino.
But we can't catch the neutrino.
No, we can't measure the neutrino directly because it slips away, but we can catch the electron.
Using conservation of energy again. If we know the total energy of the decay and we measure the exact energy of the electron, whatever is missing must be the mass of the invisible neutrino.
Precisely. They're looking for the absolute maximum possible energy the electron can have, what physicists call the kinematic endpoint.
Okay, the endpoint.
By analyzing the shape of the energy spectrum right at that exact endpoint, they hope to deduce the precise mass of the neutrino. Orthodox physicists at Catron are spending years and incredible amounts of funding trying to empirically narrow down this endpoint, turning their dials tighter and tighter, hoping to eventually find the exact mass.
They are just hunting for the number.
But the KUT framework essentially looks at these massive empirical endeavors and says, we can save you the time and the money. The fundamental geometry of the rendering universe demands the mass scale is roughly 0.06 eV. You are not going to find anything drastically different because the knot and the lattice do not permit any other value.
It's a fascinating clash of scientific paradigms. And this raises an important question, maybe the most important question for the sociology of modern science.
What's that?
If a zero-parameter geometric derivation matches the satellite data perfectly, at what point do we stop drawing Ptolemaic epicycles? At what point does the physics community abandon the infinitely small point particle and accept that a tumbling knot provides a cleaner, derived answer?
Well, the authors of the Dirac-Lynch synthesis are actually quite vocal about this resistance. They referred to the persistence of the old model as the Platonic pathogen.
The Platonic pathogen, meaning like an infection of idealized perfect shapes that don't actually exist in reality.
Exactly. Plato loved the idea of perfect dimensionless points and perfect circles. The physics community fell in love with the mathematical elegance of the zero-dimensional point particle, particularly because QED made such accurate predictions.
But it's an illusion.
The pathogen is the absolute refusal to let go of that idealized point, even when it generates catastrophic infinities, even when it requires renormalization, and even when it forces you to invent a seven-parameter matrix just to explain a simple neutrino.
It's stubbornness. It is the immense inertia of a scientific establishment that has spent 100 years building a towering skyscraper on a foundation of point particles. To admit the foundation is crooked, even if it solves the mysteries of the universe, requires tearing down a lot of very famous equations.
It requires a paradigm shift on the level of moving from Newton to Einstein. But the beauty of the Noetherian framework isn't just that it solves the math.
There's more.
It's that it offers a profound philosophical and structural reason for why the universe is built this way. The fact that the universe creates these tumbling, unanchored ghosts that slip through the ice at 0.06 eV isn't just a random accident of geometry.
So it serves a purpose.
It reveals something about the universe's design. The sources call it the mercy of the lattice.
Yes, the mercy of the lattice. This brings us to the final and perhaps most poetic element of our deep dive today. Let's talk about the universe as an engine and the neutrino as its exhaust.
This is where the physics takes on an almost ethical structural significance. Let's revisit those high energy events that create neutrinos. The core of a star or a supernova collapse. The papers refer to the generative mechanics of the universe as the Abraxian engine.
The Abraxian engine, meaning the underlying computational or rendering mechanism that actually ties the knots and updates the lattice?
Correct. The universal driver. Now, in a supernova, massive, incomprehensible amounts of topological energy are being released in a highly localized area. The Abraxian engine is striking nodes into motion at a furious, catastrophic rate.
That's just churning them out.
Now let's run a thought experiment. What if the universe was rigid? What if it forced every single node that was struck in that supernova to fully anchor?
Oh, like if the universe demanded that every single trefoil knot pay the Higgs torsion threshold and grind into the pentagonal floor to become solid matter,
Exactly. If every single potential particle in a collapsing star was forced to crystallize into solid anchored ash, the sheer density of that localized geometric friction would be catastrophic.
Because there's too much energy in one spot.
It would exceed what physics calls the Planck density ceiling. That's the absolute maximum limit of energetic information that the Chiroq lattice can sustain in one location.
What happens if you exceed the Planck density ceiling?
The geometric fabric of the vacuum itself shatters. The localized friction would literally tear the spatial rendering manifold apart.
Oh, wow. I need to synthesize this for you, listening, because when I grasped this, it gave me literal chills. The neutrino isn't Pauli's ghost, and it isn't a random glitch in the standard model. It is the universe's exhaust valve.
An exhaust valve, yes.
When the Abraxian engine is running too hot, when a star collapses and the topological energy is too violently dense, the Chiroq lattice exhibits mercy. It lets the pressure off.
It prevents a blowout.
It allows trillions of these knots to slip through. It allows them to hydroplane away as unanchored, tumbling, partial rendering events.
Yes. They carry the excess energy out of the danger zone, radiating outward at the speed of light without forcing the knots to anchor, which would overheat and shatter the local lattice. The neutrino exists as a structural necessity to protect the fabric of reality from tearing itself apart from its own friction.
That completely flips the script.
Yeah.
The engine breathes because the engine was geometrically necessitated to breathe. The neutrino is the steady exhalation of an engine that has been burning and rendering for billions of years without breaking its own geometry.
That is the exact conclusion of the 10th derivation. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it represents a massive shift in how humanity views the cosmos.
We are moving away from a universe of brute descriptive facts.
Right. A universe where we just measure a neutrino mass of 0.06 eV, write it on a chalkboard, shrug, and say, I guess that's just how the universe is.
We are moving into a universe of structural geometric necessity. Every constant, every interaction, even the whisper-thin mass of a tumbling ghost particle, exists to mathematically balance the Abraxian engine.
It's a completely interconnected holographic reality. Nothing is isolated.
The friction of the massive proton is mathematically, inextricably linked to the faint tumbling of the neutrino, which is entirely linked to the irrational pentagonal shape of the vacuum floor. It's one single elegant system.
It is the shift from a universe that simply happens to be here to a universe that must be exactly as it is because the foundational geometry demands it.
Okay, we have covered an immense paradigm-shifting amount of ground today. Let's bring all these threads together to close out this deep dive. Let's recap the journey we just took.
Sounds good.
We started with the mathematical failures of orthodox physics, the impossible infinities and the hocus-pocus fudge factors caused by the Platonic pathogen of pretending particles are infinitely small, dimensionless points.
We examined how that assumption forced the invention of seven-parameter epicycles just to explain the oscillation of the neutrino.
We then explored the Dirac-Lenz synthesis, discovering a stunning alternative. A universe made of physical 3D3, two torus knots grinding against an irrational 5D pentagonal floor called the Chiroq lattice.
We discovered that mass isn't a property, it's a geometric grinding tax.
And we realized that the mysterious neutrino is just a partial rendering event, a hydroplaning tumbling knot that hit black ice and couldn't quite anchor.
And we saw how its phase ringing, its continuous tumbling through three distinct faces, effortlessly creates the illusion of three flavors.
And most importantly, how the mathematical calculation of that tumbling perfectly predicts its 0.06 electron volt mass without a single empirical dial being turned, all operating as a universal exhaust valve to protect the cosmos from self-destruction.
It is a breathtaking theory.
So I want to ask you, the listener, how does it feel? Reconsidering the very space around you right now. Look at your hand. Look at the room you are in. I want you to view it not as an empty void filled with tiny, dead billiard balls randomly bumping into each other in the dark,
but as a dense, mathematical, computational lattice.
A living, rendering floor where every single particle in your body is an ongoing, active geometric performance. A tiny tornado continuously tying itself into existence, paying a friction tax to reality millisecond by millisecond just to maintain its solidity.
It is a profound realization of interconnectedness. And as we consider that interconnectedness, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to explore on your own. This idea is drawn from the very edges of the source text, specifically teasing the upcoming 11th zero-free parameter derivation.
The 11th derivation, what does it hint at?
We've talked extensively today about the knot, the the lattice and the engine-mundering the universe, but what about the observer? What about the mind comprehending the knot?
The human mind.
If the mass of the proton, the temperature of the cosmos, and the tumbling of the neutrino are all just harmonic mathematical echoes of this one fundamental 3-2 torus knot rendering on the pentagonal lattice, what if the conscious observer is too?
What do you mean?
What if you, the person listening to this audio right now, are just the ultimate fractional feedback loop? If all matter is just geometry, then your brain is just geometry.
Wait a second.
Are we just the universe's geometry, finally achieving the structural complexity required to look back at itself through a telescope or an equation and read its own underlying code?
Wow. Are you just the universe reading its own code? That is a heavyweight thought to take with you today. We want to enthusiastically thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material.
It's been a journey.
It is dense, it is radical, and it fundamentally challenges everything we thought we knew about the building blocks of reality. Keep looking closely at the world. Keep asking why the universe works the way it does. And most importantly, keep questioning the reality beneath your feet. Because, as we learned today, the floor of reality is a lot more complex and a lot more beautiful than an empty void.
Until next time, keep seeking the patterns.